Okay, I think we're going to start. I'm pressing the start button. Okay, welcome everybody. So my name is David, and as you can see, I am French. I'm sorry for that. So I'm going to try to speak in English. You know, we've got two ways of speaking English, French guys. We can speak like that with our marvelous French accent, or we can speak most of the time properly good English. Let's hope so. I will bet maybe less good than you speaking English, but I will better to say croissant or baguette, even if it's not really appropriate for this talk. So what we're going to see is some new HTML5 and CSS3, the latest feature in actions. The idea is to show some very simple demonstrations for some of them, and I will try to show them in more complex scenarios. So I've been working on HTML5 for a couple of years now, and I'm also working on the Windows 8 HTML5 application for the French store, so I'm going to share some of my expertise here. So what we're going to see is Microsoft is really committed to web standards. You're going to see a lot of really cool things inside i10 and coming from the W3C, and some of the features we've pushed to the W3C. You're going to see also that i10 really provides some compelling and immersive experience thanks to the immersive browser. And thanks to hardware acceleration, you can do a lot of great stuff now in the browser. And i10 is really great for touch. So this is really something you got to get in mind when you will design your new website. Think about touch, because now we will have a really cool new devices. You are lucky enough to have a surface, I think, at the end of the day. So think about that when you will build some new website. The cool thing is that most of the technology we're going to see today are working fine inside the Windows 8 app, meaning that everything you're going to learn in the i10 browser, in HTML5 in general, will work inside the Windows 8 apps. So the agenda, we will start by reviewing some new CSS3 layout and animation and how it works. Then we will concentrate ourselves on the new HTML5 APIs like Indexed DB, application cache, stuff like that. And we conclude by touch support. French people are also well known to be late. Let's hope I won't be late today. So the first section is about layout and animation. And well, I guess if you've already done some CSS, some of the layout could be really a nightmare to build in CSS 2.1. So let's see how the new specification could help you in the future. So there is a lot of CSS and SVG features in i10, so some of them were already present in i9, like the 2D transformer or the specification. We're going to see right now some of them, because we only had 1 hour, so we're going to see 3D transform, animation, multicolon, transition, grid alignment, and exclusion, also known as positioned floats. So let's start by grid, one of my favorite ones. Let's imagine you want to build this layout for a game in HTML and CSS. Maybe the oldest of us will use some table element, which is really bad. And now we can do the very same thing using some pure CSS, using the layout, CSS re-layout. The idea is to build a grid here with 3 rows and 2 columns. And you see that you've got some dynamic parts, because we don't want to think about pixels. We want to think about fluid layouts. So we're going to use some fraction units. The idea is to build some layout that would work on every device, what will be the resolution. So thanks to the grid layout, we can now build this kind of game in the browser. So how it works? Well, the first thing you need to do is to have some div. It could be some semantic tags, it could be some classic div, whatever you want, to really try to structure the layout we've got on the right. So we've got a global container, which is named the grid one. And then we've got 5 div for the title, for the score of your game, statistics, board, and control. Now that I've defined my HTML, the idea is to put every of these HTML elements into proper cells. The first thing you need to do to build a grid layout is to switch the display into the grid one. So currently, this specification is in draft mode, so it needs to be prefixed by the MS vendor prefix. So you need to put -ms-grid to switch the display to grid. Then you need to define the number of columns you'd like to use. So I need to use 2 columns. The first one will have the size based on the content that we put inside it, so it's automatic. And the second one will use all the available space remaining using a fraction unit. And you will maybe better understand in the demonstration just after that. Then I want three rows. Again, the first one will be automatics, so the size will be computed based on the content I will put inside the first row. Then I want to use all the remaining available space in the middle. And finally, the third row will be, again, automatic. Now I've got my grid defined. I need to use some CSS selectors to put every HTML element inside the grid. So this is very pretty simple. You just have to use whatever CSS selector you want to use. It's a very simple one. And then you're going to put, for instance, the title in the first column in the first row. And for instance, the control will be put in the second column in the third row. You can even choose to align vertically or horizontally if you want to, which is, could be something very complex to do without this grid layout specification. So this is really, really awesome and very easy to use. And this is the base of most of the layout we've got also in Windows 8 apps. So let's switch to my machine to show you it works. And to see the first demonstration. This is a beautiful layout. So I'm not a designer. I am a developer. I'm not really good to choose the color. And this layout is interesting because it's going to see I'm going to resize the window. And I've decided that the logo and the subcontent logo should take 1/3 of the height, and the subcontent should take 2/3 of the height. Whatever will be the resolution, if I'm moving that, the ratio is always the same. So let's have a look to the code. So I'm pressing the F12 key, which is our development bar in IE, and I'm going to target, for instance, this element, and I'm going to go over there. So if you see here, I'm defining two rows, one FR and two FR, to say that the first row will then take 1/3 of the height of my global window, and the second one will take 2/3 of the remaining space. You see? So you can then build some layout without being pixel-based, which is really, really great, because if you combine that with some SVG, for instance, you can build some layout that will work on any kind of device and resolution in a very simple way. So now if I want, for instance, to have 50 persons for both of them, I'm going to change the definition of the rows to use one FR, and you see now I've got 50 persons all the time in my layout. So feel free to have a look to this specification. It's really, really nice. It came from IE10. We've pushed the specification to the W3C, so it's actually in a draft mode, and really hope that other vendors will implement that quickly. Now, if you want to use other specification, I guess that most of you know what media queries are. So who knows media queries in the room? Most people. So the idea of media queries is to set some rules to react to some of the resolution or maybe also orientation. So we're going to talk about orientation here. So my first layout has been designed to work great in a landscape mode. So the idea is to have some CSS rule to target the landscape mode. So you've got a media query rule for that. Well, you see, you've got to say that if my tablet or my PC is currently in landscape mode, I want to apply this current piece of CSS and then to put all div in the proper cells. But if I want to move my tablet in the portrait mode, I want this layout being used because it's better for the games and it's better than stretching, you know, the first board. To do that, you just have to define another rule, another media query rules, targeting the portrait orientation, and then you can define another grid if you like to, and use some other way of distributing every piece of HTML in the proper cells. Again, this is very easy to use and very powerful to target a lot of devices. So I've got a demo for that, of course. Could you see that? Okay. So this time, you see, when I'm residing the border, I'm simulating the fact that I got a portrait mode or landscape mode. But it's even better if you're using the Windows simulator. If you don't know why it is a Windows simulator, it's a tool that's coming with the SDK of Windows 8 development, so with Visual Studio 2012. And it's really helpful to test your design in various resolution and even testing the CSS media query rules. So for instance, if now I'm moving my tablets on the right, you're going to see that now the CSS rule has been applied to handle the portrait mode. So it's very easy to do. You've got to work with some designer, because I guess that us developers are not really the best guys to build this kind of layouts, at least the colors for sure. But combining CSS media queries and grid layouts helps you to build some really pretty simple layout that work pretty well on all devices. So now we've seen the layout using grid. There is another cool specification. So it's one of my favorites. The first one is 3D transform. So if you already know 2D transform, that helps you to, via using CSS, to do some rotations, queuing, translation on any element of your document. 3D transform only just add a new dimension, the third one. And we're going to see how it works. It's very simple. In a very simple line of code, you can to move elements in the 3D space. Multicolon is really helpful to help you building some layouts that you usually see in print media, meaning that we know that our eyes are better to read a small line rather than very big line on the complete width of the screen. Our eyes are being built like that, so we need to adapt the layout for that. Up to now, it was very complex to do that using classic CSS 2.1. With CSS 3, it's just one line of CSS to do that, and the layout engine will build a multicolon for you. Coupled with hyphenation, it really improves the global readability of your text. We're going to see that also. Finally, the CSS free position float, also named as CSS exclusion, could help you to put an element in your global flow and as a float one, but it's going to interact with the text itself. The text is going to flow around the element in a very simple way again, and it really helps you to breathe some layout you usually see in the print media, but coupled with the new technology of the web, meaning that you don't have to copy-paste some print media layout. You just use the best part of them, coupled with media queries and all the new web design that are going to scale for all on all devices. So rather than talking too much of this slide, I'm going to show you some code. And this demonstration, you can see it online. It's on the iTest Drive, the website. And as you can see now, in CSS 3D Transform, you can simply move on the new axis one of your elements. So it's not possible to do that in 2D Transform. And you could also translate into 3D space. So for instance, I can move my element this way and move on the Z index. And you see the result is here. It's very simple, just in one line of CSS to do that. Well, the real complexity is not to code that, it's to know what to do with that properly in your website. And again, you need to work with people that are good in building UX stuff. But for you, developer, it's really simple to implement. Maybe you have seen that the transform property is not prefixed anymore. So since i10 RTM, we are not prefixing a lot of new CSS free features like transformation. And we also that transition and animation are not prefixed anymore in i10. So you can use the very standard way of CSS inside i10. So we will going to see a nice demo of that in the game I've built just after that. Now we're going to see some CSS exclusion. So just to let you know that this global space is currently using some CSS grid layout we've seen at the beginning. So it's got four rows and four columns defined. And also, I'm going to use the multicolon property. But let's concentrate ourselves on this float element. Currently, the float element don't have any interaction with my text. If I want to put that inside the text and let the text flow around that, I've got to switch it to the flow wrap properties, which is currently prefixed. Thank you, guys. And so now I'm going to move this element. As I told you, I'm using some grid definitions. I'm going to move on the second column, on the second row, and I can even ask it to use two column span this way. And you see that it's going to interact with the rest of the text. You don't have to do anything complex to do that. Just to set one property on your float elements, and you're done. If we have a look to the code again, using the F12 bar, I'm going to click on this element and refresh the DOM. You see, if I'm disabling this property, so all the magic is there. Only one line of code. It's really cool. If I'm removing that, it's just a float element that's going to live with the text, with no interaction at all. So you're just putting one CSS line of code, and you're done. This is very cool. So you can do with some really, really interesting layouts inside web pages. Now you see that we've got here some multi-column text. So again, not very complex. I'm going to click on the div. And this is defined here. I've currently asked to have two columns, and the layout engine will automatically bridge some two columns for you. I should have shut a lot of my application. And for instance, if I'm putting three columns here, you see that the layout engine is doing the job for you again. Very simple to do again. Some of the guys, this is the birthday, one of the guys in the room. Very interesting. So to recap, what we've seen here is we're currently using CSS multi-columns and grid layouts and exclusion. So you could combine all these new features together to build some very interesting layouts, something that could be, if you remember about CSS 2.1, it would be really, really complex to do that just using CSS with no JavaScript code at all. So now I'm going to show you a game I've been working on, so because I like games. And I've built some games using some HTML5. So it's in the other browser. So I've pinned my game here. It's a platformer game running full screens. Thanks to the hardware acceleration of i10, I've got the maximum frame rate possible on my screen. So, and I can play to my game. It's a canvas, HTML5 canvas game. And I've just enhanced the experience for i10 user and browser supporting CSS 3D transform and transition to enable new things. So for instance, I'm using the 3D transform when I'm going to go to the next level. I've got the 3D transform to load to the next level. So maybe you're wondering how the animation works. So we need first to concentrate ourselves on the animation, and I would then explain you how to build some very simple animation. Just some teasing. So to do some animation with CSS, you've got two ways to do that, rather than transition or animation. Maybe you already use some jQuery frameworks to do some animation on your pages, so well, which is good, but jQuery is not using hardware acceleration for the animation. And CSS3 on most platforms, if you're using CSS3 on Windows 8 or on iOS, it will be hardware accelerated, so it's very interesting to use them. So the first thing is transition. Transition helps you to move from state A to state B. If you're not using transition in CSS 2.1, for instance, and you're moving one of your elements to, let's say, to the border left to the border right, it will be taken immediately with no transition at all. Transition will handle the animation between both states. So you get to specify on which property you'd like to work to launch the animation. Then you've got to specify the duration of the animation. And finally, you've got either linear function to do the animation, which is not really good to be some linear function, or easing function. The browser will handle the animation for you, meaning that you don't have really some control between state A and state B. The browser will handle for you. That's why it's named fire and forget. You've got one event you can register to, transition end, to tell you that the animation is finished, you want to plug some JavaScript code at the end of the animation. Again, this is not prefixed because i10 is using the unprefix version, but if you're building some code today for old browser, maybe you will have to add the vendor prefix, either WebKit or Mozilla one, to make it work on every browser. If you want to have more control on the step between the first state A and state B, maybe you need to define some keyframes. Keyframes are handled by animation. You can see animation like a series of transition, if you like to. And again, you get to specify on which property you want to work with, the timing function and the duration. You can have delay on both of them. For instance, if you do want the animation to be triggered immediately, you can have some slight delay on that. So let's have some code review. I'm going to switch back to the desktop. And I've put that on GS Fiddle. Who knows GS Fiddle in the room? Oh, most of you. Well, if you don't know that, have a look. It's really pretty cool to share some very piece of code with your colleagues, or to raise some bugs, or to write article if you need to share some code with some people. The idea is you're going to define here your HTML. So my HTML is pretty simple. It's just a div named red rectangle. I guess you know why. And then you see in the CSS part, I'm going to define here, so a web sprayer with a background color. But the most interesting part is a transition. So I'm going to define a transition here. I'm going to to do some transition on all property during 1 second using an easing function. Then when I will hover my mouse over this element, I want to change the color, and I want to have some rotation and scaling at 10%. Just using this piece of CSS here will do the magic for me. It will do the animation. It will work on any properties and do the animation for me. Animation will then be done on the color itself and on the scaling transform properties. So now, here it is. Nothing complex, you see? If I want just to animate only one property, I can change that to transform. Going to rerun that. And now you see, it's not animating the color changes. It's just animating the transformation itself. So you can really choose on which property you want to work with, but you can choose the in fine way, the animation between the state A and state B. If you want to have more fine control, you're going to use animation. So I forgot to tell you, I'm a huge Star Wars fan, so I'm a really boring fan of Star Wars. So I'm sorry for that. So what I'm currently going to do is defining some keyframes here, which is, again, unprefix. Maybe we need to prefix that for other browser. And then you are going to work again on the transform property, so the 2D transform property. And I've got six steps on my keyframes to define my animation. Once I've done that, I've given it a name to that, and I will really handle the animation here. So I'm reusing the various keyframes I want to animate during 7 seconds, and I can choose how many times I want the animation to be launched. So in this case, an infinite number of times, but you can say, during 5 times, I want the animation to be triggered. And as you've got some event you can register to, you can control full JavaScript, some specific code you'd like to plug at the end of the animation or during each iteration. This is difficult to say for me. So you see, very simple, no JavaScript at all to do that. And this demo is part of a bigger one I've put on my blog to animate some Star Wars machine, so it's at. So it's part from another demo from Anthony. His name is Anthony, who built that, and I've just modified the code to make it work on i10. So, and now if you're using an unprefix version, it will work on any browser. I know what you're currently thinking of. Well, I can't see the purpose of this animation to enhance my website. Again, I am a developer, I'm a geek like you, so just to demonstrate what you can do with these technologies, it's maybe the best way to do that on your website, but it's just to demonstrate it. So now if you come back to my game, you will have a better idea on how it works. So the first thing I've done, when I'm resizing the browser, I want some smooth animation to be raised, like this way. And this is done only with one CSS line of code, which is transition. I want to transition on all properties. So when I'm residing my browser, it's going to do the animation for me. Very easy to do. And now let's have a look to handle the funny part, which is the animation here, this one. So it's just a combination of what I've already seen before. So let's have a look to the CSS. And in the CSS, I'll define, again, a transition on 1 second using an easy function. And I've got two CSS class. The first one is being set during the loading. So you see that it's a normal scaling with 0 degrees of rotation. And when I'm loading the next level, I'm just changing the class to set these properties by putting some specific class on my canvas. And then transition will do the job for me. So let's imagine that I'm going to transform that. You see, it's done automatically with no JavaScript at all. It's done by the browser in an accelerated way. can do the opposite. And the fun part, I can still play to my game. I'm not sure the gameplay is really the best one, but it's still possible, and I'm going to lose. Oh, you died. So maybe you will be better than myself to build some new gameplay. So we've seen my game. So let's concentrate ourselves now on the new HTML5 APIs. Again, there is a lot of new stuff in i10, some existing stuff coming from i9, and i10 brings some new cool API from the W3C. So we're going to concentrate on application cache, drag and drop, forms, which is really cool, IndexedDB, so it's database available client-side, file reader APIs and web workers to enhance potentially the performance on your website. Let's start with the application cache. As you see in my game, I don't have any interaction with some web server. Everything is being done on the client side. So it's really too bad if the web server is not available anymore, if I want to let my little boy playing to my game. Maybe he wants to play the game without any internet connection. I've already have all the file on the client side, but I need maybe to help the browser to learn that without any internet connections. So the HTML5 application cache helps you to define which file you like to cache on the client side when you don't have any connection. So it's based on the manifest file, we're going to see that. And the idea, when you want to resynchronize the file from the server to the client, you need to modify the manifest itself. So you don't have any delta modification. You cannot choose to only update two files, for instance. You've got to resynchronize all the files from the server every time you want to do some synchronization on the client side. So there is a very simple example. You've got the root HTML5 on the left, which is using some classical tags. You've got the specific property on the main HTML tag, which is a manifest attribute, when you're going to put the name of the file containing the manifest. So the manifest is on the right. You've got to start with cache manifest. And then we've got a comment. I'm going to tell you why we're using this kind of comments. And then I'm going to ask the browser to cache the main HTML5, of course, and all the CSS JavaScript I need to work in offline mode. You're not forced to. The first strategy could be I'm going to synchronize my complete website on the client side. This is not really a good idea. Maybe you just want to choose part of your website available in offline mode. So you got to really think about what we're going to push to your user when the internet connection is not available anymore. So it's why you're choosing part of the file of your website. In my case, for my game, I've synchronized everything because the experience is the same rather than online or offline, but this is not the case for classical websites. You've got to specify the MIME type over there. If you don't specify it, some browser won't understand the file, the manifest file, and won't cache anything. So beware of that. On your web server, don't forget to add this MIME type if it's not set already. So once you're able to run your application in an offline mode, and you've got some really powerful CSS layouts and new APIs to work with, maybe you want to interact with the data of the user on his hard drive. Before this API, the only thing you could do is using some input tag, take the file, and send that to the web server without being able to do anything on the file. So let's imagine you want to rescale some picture before sending that to the web server to save some bandwidth. It wasn't possible before. Now you can read some file from the hard drive. This is already based on permission from the user. The user is going to be prompted to choose some files to provide that to your JavaScript code, and then you can work on that. You cannot directly access to the hard drive without letting the user know for obvious security reason. Once you've done that, you've got some object to work with. The main one is a file reader object, so you're going to instantiate that in your code, and then you will be able to use some methods to read some text, to read some image as data URL, or you have access to a new type of available, like array buffer, if you want to work that. So we're going to see in the code that's very simple to use. So the first function is retrieving some file given by the user using some input file tag. So you're going to have access to one or many files. So I'm going to take the first one. And if I have a file being provided by the user, I'm then going to provide that to the second function that will then load the text from the file. So let's imagine this is a text file in this case. So the code is very pretty simple. So you're going to instantiate the file reader to use a read as text function, and everything is asynchronous to avoid to freeze the UI thread. So you've got three events to work with. The on-progress element could be a good idea to tell to the user that currently a big file is being loaded. And you've got the unloaded, which is a success one, and the error if you've got problem accessing to your hard drive. I'm going to give you some demonstration of that just after that. Another cool thing to work with the file APIs is a drag and drop. So there's two ways to drag and drop. You can rather define some drag and drop in the same page. So let's imagine you want to move one of your HTML elements in the web page. You just have to make it draggable. But another cool scenario, you can take some files from the desktop, drag and drop in the broader window, and do something. And we're going to see some example of doing that. And when you drag and drop a file into the desktop, you're going to use a file API to read the data. HTML file forms is really some really interesting things to work with touch, because when I'm building some websites, most of the time you're doing some repetitive tasks like a form validation before sending the data to the server, or maybe you want to structure the keyboard layout in a specific way. Now it's being handled natively by the desktop, meaning that the validation stuff is done for you. You don't have to write any more regex if you're not really good in regex. This is done by the browser. And you're going to see that the keyboard will change based on what we're going to use. So let's have a demo of HTML5 forms. A very, very simple one. Here it is. I couldn't make it more simple, I guess. So I've got the form tags here, and we got some new type, input type. Before, we only have some text inputs. Here now I can have some email inputs, and I can even ask that this input should be required, meaning that I can go to the next step without any value inside that. And then I've got a classical submit button. Just by doing that, if I'm opening that in the browser, you see the marvelous layout I've got here. If I try to submit, I've got some automatic validation by the browser done by the HTML5 specification. So this is done for you. This is really great. I know what you're thinking. Maybe you don't like the way it's being done. So you've got some new pseudo classes you can work with to change the design of that. And if I'm trying to add some fake addresses, submit queries, it tells me that you got to enter a valid email address. As you know, it's waiting for some email addresses. It's going to add some specific validation for that. So you don't have to write any more code. And it's working fine. Very easy to use. And the good news is if the browser doesn't support this property, it falls back to the classical input text element. So it's already working with all the browser. The latest browser will provide some nice validation. Now, if I'm going to see that in a more complex scenarios, I'm going to change the zoom. And if I'm using the virtual keyboard, for instance, the one of your marvelous Surface, even if you have some type cover, if I'm touching this one, you see that the layout has changed a little bit. I've got the arrow mask over there. And I'm moving the web page and I'm touching input type member, the keyboard has been changed automatically. So you don't have to code anything to have that. Just use the new HTML forms tags and you will have this experience for you. So we start to use that right now. It's working on every website and will enhance the experience for your user on your website. So let's see now how I've used all that inside my game. So the first thing I'm going to do is to unplug the network. And let's hope it will work. You see some live demo. If I'm opening IE, I don't have any connection. But if I'm opening my game, it's still working fine. Because I've used the manifest file to say that I want all the JavaScript, CSS, and every framework I need. I'm using the EaselJS framework. If you don't know that, it's a really pretty cool framework to build some HTML5 games. Everything has been downloaded and synchronized in an offline mode. As you can see, I've just added the offline logo to tell to the user it's working in offline mode. And this is working fine. Now I've done another thing in the game. Maybe this level is not really great to play with. I've got the best available level editor in the world. This is not bad. And the way my level I designed, I'm going to say that the player should start the game here and should exit here. This is a bad guy, a monster, and this is the way to collect some points. Once you've done that, you're going to drag and drop the file in the browser and going to load the level. So this is really cool. And you see that if I'm too bad, well, no problem, just going to remove the bad guy. Say, drag and drop, up, it's better now. So I'm going to just replug the cable. And let's have a look at how it works. So again, F12, and going to have a look to the code, which is here. And this is very simple again. You've got to choose the element you want to monitor. So in my case, this is a canvas element. You've got several events to register to. I'm just interested in a drop event. What I'm going to do is to prevent the default behavior, because you know when you're drag and dropping some file to the browser is going to try to open the file. If it's an image, it's going to show you the image. What I like to do is retrieve the data from the file. So this is done like that. And once I've got access to the first file, I've got some very simple verification that it's a text file. And then I'm going to use the file reader. Yeah. I'm going to use the file APIs combined with the drag and drop APIs. And when I've got all the data I want, I'm going to load the next level in my game logic. So this is separate from that. So not very complex to implement, I guess. So maybe we want to have some more complex storage available on the client. Again, if we are in offline mode, it could be cool to have a database. So the W3C is giving us the IndexedDB specifications. So this is not something you're used to maybe when you're using some SQL database. This is not a relation database. It's not based on the SQL language to query it. It will, you can see that NoSQL database if you want to. So you're going to store some objects, some JavaScript object inside the DB and going to request it, some data using some specific attributes on your object. The cool thing is that we don't have any dependency on the browser implementation, of course, as this is an official W3C specification, and your call will work on all browser in the same way. So we're going to have a quick look to how it works. So again, I've built a simple application that may be not the best layout, but I have a nice layout just after that. You see, I'm really good building some layout. So currently, I've got some images stored in my database, and I can open some of them, for instance, a screenshot of my game, another game I've been working on. And everything has been currently stored in my DB. So let's have a look to the code to understand how it works. So this is here. So the first thing you're going to do is to open the database itself. What you need to understand also with IndexedDB is that everything is asynchronous, which is really important to have some good performance and to avoid to freeze the UI thread. And everything is based on transaction. So this working fine inside a worker, we're going to see just after that, because it's thread safe. And the first thing you need to do then is open a new DB named ImageViewer. If it doesn't exist yet, it's going to create it. And I would subscribe to an event, say, I need to upgrade my schema. And when you've got in this code, I'm going to create what we call a table. So the table will be named image, where all my images are going to be stored. And the key pass to find back some elements inside this table will be the name property of my objects. Now let's have a look to the load list code. that's going to query all the current available image in the DB to show the various options. So the first thing, again, is to create a transaction, because everything is transaction-based in IndexedDB. So I'm going to do a transaction on a list of different tables. I've got only one table here, so my array got only one element. And once I've got my transaction object, I could retrieve the table this way. And then I'm going to do like a for each, if you want to, inside my table using some the cursor APIs. So I'm going to open the cursor, which is in Synchronous. And once it's worked fine, I will be called back in the unsuccess event. And I can then retrieve the element itself in the DB. And to go to the next element, you're going to use the continue function. So using this code, I'm going to read all the currently available elements in my DB to populate the option. And when the user will click on open this file, open from DB, it's an old version, we're switching to the read object function. So the switch object function, again, is using some transaction. And is using some event to register to. And what I'm going to do is to use the store, the table images, and get the file name. So the file name is really the index to have access to the element in my case, but it could be whatever you want. You've got to decide yourself what will be the key to access to your element in your DB. So I've got a nice demonstration to show you. This one. So it starts to use most of the specification I've been sharing with you. We've got some grid layout here. We've got some transition being used here. And the idea is to build some slideshow working in a pure offline mode to share the photo with your friends. So let's imagine that I've got some file on my hard drive. When we were at ALE for the previous build. I'm going to choose a file to do drag and drop, and going to read through the file APIs all the image and put that at the blob object inside the IndexedDB. So this is the first step. Once I've done that, maybe I want to choose some images to build my slideshow. You see, I'm going then to work on the slideshow objects that's going to be also serialized in the IndexedDB. And maybe I want also to choose a transition. So we're going some CSS-free transition to move from one image to another one. So it's a really nice application. And finally, I can potentially manipulate the image using the canvas element. And I'm going to store this image in the DB. So this would mean ALE. You see that now I've got some black and white image. We're going to see that on the main screen, black and white image of the Queen Mary. If I'm going back here, the original image hasn't been changed. I can even, if I want to, delete this folder. And my application will still work fine because everything has been synchronized inside my DB. So even if I'm losing the connection, I can still have access to all my elements and to my slideshow. And I can play the slideshow this way using. So this is a very interesting application we've been building in France to highlight all that you can do with all the latest specification. It's a unique application. So I will share the code with you later on. Thank you. So, web workers. Maybe you'll be facing some performance issue while using JavaScript for a specific reason. JavaScript is monothreaded by nature, meaning that everything you're going to do in JavaScript will be handled by the UI thread, which wasn't a problem 10 years ago when we were using JavaScript for a very simple task. But now, as you can see, we can build some really complex application. So if there is a specific thing you're doing that's taking too much time, maybe you've already seen this message. The current code is taking too much time to kill this application. And this not maybe the fault of the developer. It could be the fault of the developer. Maybe it's the fault of the JavaScript itself. So this is a new specification named the Web Worker. The idea is to bring some multi-threading approach, so very simple, in a very simple way, to help you free the UI thread by sending some specific code to some what we call workers. So workers could be run on a separate thread. So when you've got some multi-core CPU, it's really useful. But the way to communicate with the worker is being done by post message. So you're going to send some string or JSON object or a little bit more complex object to the worker. So you cannot directly communicate in a very fast way between workers. And another point, you don't have any access to the DOM because the DOM is not thread safe. So you cannot have access to the DOM inside a worker. So except that, you can think about improving the performance of your website. So if we're going back to games again, maybe you know the Physic Engine. So there is a Box2D library that does some Physic Engine. It could use a lot of CPU. So the idea could be to move the Physic Engine to the workers to free the UI thread. In my case, I've been working on doing some filtering on images, like we've seen in the previous demonstration. And in some specific case, if the images are too big, it's going to take several seconds. So you're going to freeze the UI. And I've got many cores on my PC and your Surface tablet also. So the idea is to use more core available thanks to that. So again, we're going to see a demonstration. So I've been working with one of my French colleagues on that. He's named David also. So we all named David in France. So what we're going to do, I'm going to browse the files to take some file on the desktop. And I'm going to apply some sepia effect. So this is a picture of my friends. It's currently processing the image using the canvas elements just to apply some sepia. And you see, it took approximately more than 2 seconds to do that. During these 2 seconds, I wasn't able to interact with my web pages because everything was handled by the UI thread. So if I'm just enabling this check case, and you need to write some code also, and I'm going to reapply the same filter, it should be faster. Let's hope so. Yes, a little bit. And the first time, you need maybe to create a worker, so we need a little bit more time. So if I'm going to reapply that, you see, I've been able to gain a little bit of performance because I'm using the two available CPUs. And the good thing is that I'm not freezing the UI thread, meaning that I can do something else while doing this filtering part. So if you have a look to the code, you've got a JavaScript file that's going to receive some data from the canvas and going to work on that and going to call the process sepia function. So we're not going to dig into that. This is some basic pixel manipulation. And is waiting for information. So once it's finished, it's going to send back the computation to the main thread and going to kill itself to avoid to use too much memories. In the main thread, what we're going to do, I'm going to define how many workers I'd like to use. So in most cases, you've got some four-core machines, so it could be a good idea to use four workers. And what I'm going to do is to create a new worker this way. So you're calling the worker constructor, giving him the name of the JavaScript code containing the thing you'd like to do on another thread. Once you've done that, you've got to say that, once you will finish your job, please call me back on this function. And then I'm going to take part of the canvas image and post it to it. If you like to, I'm going to divide the image in four parts. And I'm going to send every part of the image on workers to potentially earn the performance. So once it finishes the sepia effect, the worker is going to call me back here. And I'm going to put that into the context of the canvas, just a basic check that every worker has finished his jobs. And finally, I'm getting back the image, the data to the image to have the final result. So it's a little bit more complex to use as the previous features, but really thinks about using that to free the UI thread. And in certain circumstances, you can have some performance boost. We all know that using many cores don't always give you more performance because there is a cost of discussing with the worker. But there is some interesting cases where you can use them. Okay, let's finish by touch support, and I am on time. Incredible. So the pointer is really interesting because the idea is to write only once the code to support touch, pen or stylus, because we've seen in, during the keynote that there is a lot of cool device using some pen and a mouse. And you don't have to check if it is a stylus, a touch, or a mouse. You can write it once, and a new specification will end up for you. So you're going to follow what you usually do for mouse events, but you will have some new pointer things. So it's currently in a draft mode. We've submitted this specification to the W3C, so we really hope that other vendors will implement this specification. We had some great feedback from the communities on this specification. People said that it's being really great to work with. But as it's currently in a draft mode, you've got to use the MS prefix again. So you've got two ways of using the pointer. The first one is just to draw something with several fingers, for instance, and we will follow the various X and Y coordinates. And if you want to build some more complex gesture, we've got an object named MSGesture that will give you also the inertia of some of your elements. If you're moving an element and you throw it on the screen, the MSGesture will give you some inertia information to redo the animation like you want to do. So it reads some high-level object that will help you to build some really nice thing in a very easy way. Finally, you've got to think about what you like to enable, to touch enable on your web page using some specific CSS, and we're going to see that in the demonstration. So again, I've got two demonstrations, an ugly one, which is this one, and I've got a canvas element, and I'm going to draw on that. So the way I'm going to draw on these canvas elements, I'm going to have access to the 2D context, and I'm going to do some feature detection. So really think about feature detection in your website. Don't do any more user agent sniffing, which is really bad. In this case, I'm just checking that the browser is supporting this new pointer events. If it's the case, I'm going to listen to the MS pointer move. And that's it. If it's not the case, I'm going to listen to the mouse move. And as you can see, this is a very exact same piece of code to draw on my canvas. Now if I'm opening that in the browser, I'm going to zoom a little bit. If I'm moving the mouse, it's currently drawing the ugly square on the canvas. And after using my marvelous finger, you see, I can use also some multi-touch things on my canvas in a very simple way. This is really not complex. This is the same code you will be using the mouse. And if I'm not touching the canvas, the browser is then providing me the way to go through the page. So I've got the default behavior of touch on my web page. This is done by using this CSS property over there, MS Touch Action set to none. If I'm removing it and going back in my web page. Now if I'm touching the canvas, you see it doesn't know that I want to interact with the element. So it's giving me the default behavior. So you've got to say through the CSS property on this element, stop to use the default behavior of the browser. I want to retrieve all the pointer events and handle that in my way with my code. This is the only thing you need to do, so beware of that. And let's finish by a very pretty cool demonstration. This one. So it's going to show you that the old surface table, we've rebuilt the UI in pure JavaScript and HTML5 in a multi-touch way, you see. And we're using the CSS2 2D transform to do the scaling and rotation. And I can have several interactions using multi-touch. So if you don't tell to people that this is HTML5 running in full screen, most people won't know that it is HTML5 and JavaScript and touch. So we can really build some awesome experience within the browser. And have a look to the code on the test drive. You will see that it's not that complex to implement and to give you some idea for your own website. So what we've seen, I hope that you've seen that we recommitted to standards. So we are now using unprefixed version of animation, transition, and several other CSS features. We've pushed our touch specification and our grid layout specification to the W3C, really to improve the web standards. I think you see that we've been able to write some immersive experience running in full screen, and I did some hardware acceleration to be very fluid. And it's in regrets with touch. As you see, it's not complex to implement that, and you will provide some really nice experience to your users. So have a look to that and try to play with that on your website. So there is a lot of resources available, so you can check our demos on the iTest Drive website. And most of the demos are explained on the official IE blog, so blogs.msdn.com/IE. And we've got a complete guide for the developer on our MSDN documentation, so this slide deck will be available for you in 45 hours, I guess. And some self-promotion, my awesome blog, blogs.msdn.com/DaveRoos, which is also my Twitter account. And you will find article and the source code of a game I've shown you is available on my blog, so you could have a look to that if you want to build your own game. And that's finished. If you've got some question. It was clear enough. Yes?
I'm just curious how much of what we saw is transferable directly to building a modern app in terms of the HTML, the CSS, and the JavaScript.
Okay, so in case of my game, it's just a copy-paste because the UI guidelines for Windows 8 apps for games are simpler than for other applications. For the rest of the code, you see the SnapX application doing a slideshow. They've built with that Windows 8 apps by using almost everything except that they've been using the WinJS control to have a better integration and handling of the touch to select some element. Except that, I would say that more than 80% of the code was the same between the browser and the Win 8 apps. So it really depends on what you're going to do and how you've built your own code. Yes?
With WebWorkers, can you use anything inside the HTML5 API outside of the thread, outside of the DOM?
Yes, you can have access to IndexedDB. You can do some XML HTTP request.
Okay.
So you can do some stuff, but you cannot have access to everything linked to the DOM or visual element because it's the property of the UI thread. This is finished? Okay. Thank you. I will be available for questions and another report.